Hi folks, this is Lauren Hunt with another episode of the Guitar Podcast. Thanks for tuning in again. This is episode number 77. For those of you new to the Guitar Podcast, I want you to know that when I talk about guitars and amps and pedals and music and all, I'm conveying my opinion from my experience and learning over the years. Please email me with questions at info@theguitarpodcast.net. Check out the show notes at theguitarpodcast.net/blog. Not three slashes, I just can't say slash. It's just a beautiful Sunday morning, and I'm finishing up my coffee before I'm getting ready to go to church. Of course, I'm going to record this one in segments, but you won't know that after all the editing is done and everything. It should be just seamless and beautiful, and you'll go, man, Lauren is such a genius. Well, maybe not that, you know, but anyway, follow the Guitar Podcast on Facebook. That's where you'll chime in with comments and such. You can do that on the blog, too. Actually, you can sign in using Facebook and Twitter on the blog now. And last but not least, go to theguitarpodcast.net. Sign up for email alerts. That's where you'll get emails notifying you when a new episode has been released and other timely information regarding the Guitar Podcast, such as when a new video has come out. And I guess one other thing is, you may notice that when you go to the website, or if you get an email, you'll see some banners with some advertisers. And these advertisers are personal endorsements from me. They undergo a rigorous review for the sponsor, from the sponsor review board. If any one of them say that they don't approve of the sponsor being a sponsor of the Guitar Podcast, they're pretty much gone. They're not going to be a sponsor. Right now, all we have is iTunes and Sam Ash. So to be sure that you are dealing directly with one of our sponsors, click the banner on either the home page of the website or on the blog pages or on the email. That way you'll know. It's nobody, you know, nobody has like hijacked the brand. Anyway, it'd be kind of hard to do with iTunes because you have to go right into the application to do anything there. But anyway, I'm working hard to bring on a third advertiser. It's a world-class organization, just an amazing, amazing company, and we're working that out. But well, that pretty much wraps up the housekeeping. I'm not going to continue on too much with that. Unless, just for clarification, if you want to deal with a Guitar Podcast sponsor, go to the website and click on one of the banners. Thanks a lot. There's your morning PSA from the Guitar Podcast. I'm Lauren Hunt, and I approve of this message. All right, let's get to it. Today is going to be a listener feedback, answer a question, comment, prying Lauren's brain open, and also Google. I don't know everything, and so then there are plenty of times whenever I need to ask somebody else or Google it, see what I can find, and find the best information and gather and summarize and make my own conclusions from there and recommendations to you. So the first one comes from Gary, and Gary's from Delaware, Ohio. He says, just a couple questions if you don't mind. First, does it harm guitars if you hang them on the wall with hangers that can be bought from stores like Guitar Center, I'm going to say Sam Ash, will it hurt the necks, etc.? Second, did you know that on June 10th, the Ohio Guitar Show is being held in Columbus, Ohio? Hope to see you there. All right, Gary, I've had my guitars hanging from wall hangers for years, and you'll go into places like Guitar Center and Sam Ash and all sorts of guitar stores, and they hang their guitars on the walls there. Nobody seems to have a problem with it. I haven't seen any problems with it. I'd like to do maybe a little more digging on it. If I find out otherwise, I will let you all know. Right now, I don't have any concerns with it. And actually, I probably have my most prized guitar locked away in a gun safe, and it's hanging up by its neck too, or by the headstock too. So, I don't really have any concerns with it. I almost prefer that than the ones that cradle at the bottom. I think they're more stable, hanging on a wall or in like a tripod setup where they're hanging from. The only thing you really have to be concerned about is the kind of plastic or rubber that's on the hanger and how it may interact with your finish. So that's another story. So anyway, you know, if that's you pretty much if you're using something along the lines of a, well, I'm not even going to comment on that. Your second question, did I know that on June 10th, the Ohio Guitar Show is being held in Columbus, Ohio? Yes, I did. Yeah, and I talked to my wife the other day. I said, hey, did you know? And then it's like right after that, I get this email from Gary. And my wife's like, yeah, now I need to look at my calendar and see what June 10th is. Oh, yeah, I should be able to do that, totally. Because, yeah, my wife is going out of town the weekend beforehand, and actually my wife and one of my kids, and I'm going to be home with the youngest kid, and we're pretty much going to terrorize the neighborhood together. And so then the following weekend, I should be able to make a guitar road trip. Woohoo! So, Gary, I hope that helps out. I hope to see you there. I was just thinking I need to get guitar podcast t-shirts printed up and then I'd wear one, but I'm not sure I'd be able to pull it off in time and get it all wrapped up and fitting everything in. But the main thing is I want to get podcasts and episodes and posts out to you guys on the RSS feed and Facebook and so on, more so than getting t-shirts. But if you guys think that you want to see t-shirts sooner than later, fire me emails, post on Facebook or whatever, you know, just, you know, if there's enough push for it, I'll be glad to do it. So anyway, thanks a lot, Gary. Next, I wanted to share with you the May 2012 Guitar Player magazine. It's got Hendrix on the cover. It's like Hendrix at 70 and has a bunch of people talking about Hendrix and his influence on them and so on and so forth. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. On page 112, there's this cool article talking about some stuff that we've talked about on here. But they just cover, in a pretty decent article, 10 ways to hot rod your guitar. It's really pretty cool. They talk about pickups and control knobs and preamps. The nut, we haven't really talked too much about that other than keeping your guitar in tune. If it's not staying in tune, that your nut might have something to do with it. Frets. What else? What do we talk about here? Auto-tune systems of all things. Bridge saddles, tremolos, necks, tuners. It's a lot of crazy stuff. So, let's see. Is that it? Yeah, that's it. So, it was a good article. I recommend it. And, you know, like I said, I'm not sponsored by Guitar Player magazine or anything. I just get it, and I like it. Wanted to share that with you. So if you're looking at it, it's just another article, just something else about Hendrix. There's some valuable stuff in here on that, in that particular article. Now then, here's another little tidbit from a cool guitar magazine I like a lot, and that is Vintage Guitar Magazine. It's the July 2012 issue. With Billy Duffy on the cover with his cool white falcons and the white falcon that was painted black. Anyway, there's this little bitty article, it's not even an article, it's just a little blurb about on page 16, bottom left-hand corner, film offers look at Strat making. Fender recently released A Strat Is Born, a short film that takes viewers on a high-speed ride through the creation of a Fender Stratocaster guitar. The film, shot in Fender's primary U.S. manufacturing facility in Corona, California, showcases the hand craftsmanship involved in the making of the instrument. The film was produced in part to offer a look at the process as it can be experienced at the Fender Visitor Center factory tour, adjacent to the Corona factory. The piece is set to a soundtrack by Fender endorser Wayne Kramer, co-founder of the MC5. It can be viewed at fender.com/stratisborn/press. So I'll share that link in the show notes, and I'm going to watch it. Don't know how long it is. Hopefully it's one where you can sit back and relax and watch in amazement and start dreaming about Fenders. So again, it's fender.com/stratisborn/press. So check it out. Perhaps some of you already knew this, but Earl Scruggs passed away earlier this spring, and I had no idea. I didn't get a notification from my Google Alerts or anything, I guess because I don't have banjo on my Google Alert, but Earl Scruggs was like the innovator of banjo picking in the 20th century. He's probably more innovative than just about, I mean, I don't know if you can name a guitar player who is as innovative at their craft as what Scruggs was with his. You know, we could throw out like that Texas blues style as a description for a style of blues that's incorporated by people like Stevie Ray Vaughan or Billy Gibbons or or Kenny Wayne Shepherd, that sort of thing. But in all of them, they're all kind of standing on the shoulders of Hendrix in a way. But that's not Texas blues. And Hendrix is standing on the shoulders of other guys, and we won't get into that. I don't want to start an argument about Hendrix's real influences here. But anyway, Earl Scruggs developed the Scruggs style, basically. The claw, the three-finger picking with the thumb, index, and middle finger. And if you've heard banjo picking, any kind of fast banjo picking, there's no way that you haven't heard Scruggs or Scruggs style. So it's kind of wanted to, I know this isn't the banjo podcast, it's the guitar podcast, but as a guy who plays a stringed instrument, I have a lot of respect for other people who play stringed instruments, even respect and amazement and wonder and curiosity of if I would be able to handle playing that sort of an instrument. Like I do a mandolin. I'm okay with mandolin. But I don't really play the banjo or like the fiddle or violin. But those sorts of things, those sorts of stringed instruments intrigue me. So I think about, learning to play those. But I just wanted to give a pay a little homage to Earl Scruggs in his passing, and he was a big-time legend, or is a big-time legend. And if you don't know, you should know. Maybe I'll link to his wiki or something like that. You can kind of get an idea. So we're supposed to be doing listener feedback, right? So Chris emails me. I don't know where he's from, but it's a guy. Sorry, not. As a guy with a name that could be either male or female, then I get the, emails where it's, hey, you should talk to Lauren. She knows, oh, gee, that's always great. When you get your gender mixed up, it's like, good grief. You can't tell over email, right? So, anyway, Chris says, hey, wondering if you have any experience with curved frets on a true temperament neck or not straight Nirvana nut. It makes sense to me something like that can improve intonation and keep your guitar in tune at all frets, but I'm also surprised that if it works, why haven't the major guitar manufacturers figured that out and started making their guitars that way? Just wondering what your take may be. Well, Chris, I can't really speak for major guitar companies, but I would imagine that most of them, I mean, we could look at the price of some of these guitars that have the true temperament necks, the curved frets, all the wild frets and everything, how much more it may cost in production for, say, Fender or G&L or Gibson to fret instruments that way, and how much more time and labor goes into that. So there's that. And then, say, years down the line, and I don't know if they're using, honestly, I'm just speaking off the cuff here, just my personal observation without doing any research here. Unless they're using something like a good stainless steel, which there's a huge argument about, well, I guess the people splitting hairs, and that's what we do, right, about the different metals that are used in frets. And if some people would say that stainless steel sounds better, sometimes some may say that it doesn't sound as good, or it sounds, you know, whatever. But those squiggly frets and curved frets and all that stuff, if they're made of a harder steel or alloy or like stainless steel, that they won't wear down as fast as like just regular frets, regular fret wire, then, you know, that's an added cost, yes, along with manufacturing these wild necks. But there comes a point where if they don't use these higher end frets or these frets that don't wear down as much, then if the frets wear down, then they have to be replaced. And who's going to replace them? Who's going to be authorized to replace them? I mean, I guess that's where I'm coming from with that. So I've seen those fanned out fret boards. They look pretty crazy, and I don't know how well I'd be able to. If they say that playing on them is actually easier, but it looks like it would be more difficult to do a bar chord on it. Honestly, that's just my take. And then the squiggly frets. I'd love to play a squiggly fret guitar. I know you're talking about like true temperament necks or the not straight Irvana nut. Actually, those crazy frets are in here. Time out. By the way, the article with Billy Duffy is really cool. I know they're kind of promoting their new album and everything, but he just seems like a really cool dude. Just like really down to earth. Of course, he played Gibson and Marshall. Imagine why I would like that guy. There it is. Good grief. Yeah, the true temperament neck represents a bold and musical upgrade to any bolt-on neck, guitar neck. Yeah, those true temperament necks, they're like, the frets are like squiggly worms, man. They're not like straight frets. They're just, it's really crazy. Now, what guitar player is saying here is, if you want to really supercharge a guitar, check out the squiggly fret true temperament neck, which offers a radical and musical take on playing gloriously in tune in all registers. But yeah, replacing those frets would be basically impossible in case, you know, you wore them down. That neck would be just pretty much done. And, you know, once the frets are all worn down like that, you have that nice feel on the neck, worn out back neck and back of the neck, and it just, and then you can't replace the frets. So that's just a concern I would have. But, you know, as little as I play guitar now and at my age, who knows? I probably won't wear down any of the frets on my guitars anymore. I don't play like all the stinking time like I used to. Used to play all the time. Thanks for the question, Chris. That was pretty cool. Now then, Chad emails me, aka Wickerman 323. He says, Lauren, thanks for letting me pick your brain about finishing a guitar with nitro. I bought an Alder Randy Rhodes V and a maple neck with rosewood fingerboard from Warmoth about 12 years ago, and I'm finally finishing it. At the time of purchase, I got the guitar and realized that I wasn't completely sure of what I wasn't completely sure where to place the bridge or how it attached to the guitar. The bridge is a Shaler Floyd Rose and only attaching at the top of the guitar with two pivot points really confused me since I had never dealt with a floating bridge. Yeah, just a little side note, Chad, I'd have a hard time getting that measurement right too. I'd be very very concerned about the measurement of where to put a bridge like that. That's one of the concerns I have about my Tele project, is that I don't believe the holes are drilled for where the bridge would go. Maybe it is. I don't recall. I know the where the string ferrules are, I think that's there, but anyway. Anyways, I have done some research recently, and there seem to be many correct ways of applying nitro. The only agreement I have seen was to spray around 10 coats and let it cure for 3 or 4 weeks. I'm just not sure of will I need a sealer or a base coat for the nitro. I found nitro and its recommended sealer at Woodcraft. If I use sealer, how many coats and what kind of wait time between coats? Then I started the project, spray painted the body black and using spray paint, and then had flames airbrushed onto the top. Sealer was never applied to the guitar before paint, so hopefully that isn't a problem. I don't see how it will be. A sealer would help protect the paint from any of the nitro. I have read to sand between each coat of sealer if used to help scuff up the surface using 220 grit paper. Does that sound right? All right. First off, I'm not sure if you're putting nitro finish on top of a guitar that you already spray painted with like a rattle can with just regular paint. At that point, I don't know that I would. You're basically losing any of the benefits of having a nitro finish at that point, unless it's a nitro. I don't know what'd you say here. Honestly, I don't think that, you know, not putting a sealer on the body is all that big of a deal. I guess a bigger deal I do see is that, you know, you have black spray paint underneath, and now you're wanting to put a nitro finish on top of it. I just don't understand why we would want to do anything like that unless you're just wanting to do the clear coat and nitro and spend the extra money on nitro. If you want a nitro finish, what I would do is I would strip the whole thing down and start over again. And I guess the question I have for you is, what's the body look like right now after the black paint and a bit of sanding? Can you still see the grain? Is the grain filled? If not, then you need to fill the grain and get grain filler, and that's a fun project right there. I did not like doing grain filler, honestly. So next paint job, I probably won't do a whole lot of it. Another thing is, whenever they said to scuff the surface using like 220 grit paper, I don't think I would use that heavy a grit of paper. I would use something probably around like 400 or 600. Honestly, I think 600. I mean, because you're wanting to make little fine abrasions in there. 220 seems, or 200 grit sandpaper seems kind of heavy to me. Let's see. When I spray painted my guitars, all I did was I'd spray a coat on it, and I'd just stand out there and watch it and look at it and move the other side of it and spray that and look at it and watch it and see if it was, you know, I wouldn't touch it, but you could kind of tell just by looking at it that it changes from being real wet to starting to cure up just a little bit. And you can wait, I guess. Coats and layers are two different things, or applications and layer and coats are two different things. I think a coat is whenever you spray a bunch of times all around the guitar several times, maybe three or four times, and then let it sit for about you know, 20, 30 minutes, and then go back and add another coat, which it's still kind of tacky. So you're adding coat after coat after coat. That seems to work. What's it saying here? What are you saying? But yeah, letting it, once you've got the coats on there, I don't know if 10 coats is required. I'd say let your eye be your guide if it looks pretty decent. The thing is, if you let it cure for a month after that, like they're saying, and I would concur with that, is it then the, as it cures, as the paint cures, or the finish, it shrinks a little bit. And it gets thinner and thinner. And so then if it looks like it's your, if your grain's not filled in, you're going to start seeing where the lacquer has dipped into the grain. And then you're going to have to give it a little sanding and maybe some more coats of lacquer. And then, you know, really light sand and buff it out. See what happens. Sometimes buffing it out is the only way to get really, you know, to, if you're going to, you know, light sand it and buff it out, sometimes that's the only way to see where the real flaws are and if you need to reapply. And then you're like, good grief, I spent all this time. But, you know, if you want to get it right, you get it right forever, you know. Then you ask for laying the nitro. I've read to apply in light coats. I've seen anywhere from 1 to 4 hours of wait time, but for the coats, what has worked for you in the past? Sounds like I would need to do 1 or 2 coats a day for about a week. I hope I could do it quicker. Honestly, yeah, I didn't wait that long. You know, I'd spray and spray and spray and give it about 20, 30 minutes to go back out and spray and spray and spray, and I wasn't waiting 1 to 4 hours. But the last one I did... was, I think it was Shoreline Gold over, was it Olympic White? And I would do that, and then I'd just let it sit for a day whenever I could, and then I'd get back out there and spray it again, spray some more, and spray some more, and spray some more, and spray some more, until I felt like, you know, it looks pretty good, and the guy I was spraying it for would be pretty happy, and I think he was pretty happy with it. The next paragraph from Chad says, being as the finishing would take place here at home in Kokomo in southern Indiana, it could be useful to know the best time of day to spray and what the best setup is for the weather we have around here. I have heard that to spray in low humidity, which especially as of late is hard to find, the only place I have to spray here at home is inside, which I don't want to do, and have heard that it's not recommended, in a shed or out back in the door or the window, which can get very stuffy and humid or humid outside. If those don't work, then I will have to try spraying in my father-in-law's garage. I thought the spraying outdoors could work, but it's drying that concerns me. I have heard nitro can smell strong a long time after its application, and I would hate to leave it hanging on our patio for a month. Any tips for recommended setups? Well, the best setup was to set up a spray booth where you have a fan that filters air in and filters air out as it goes, so that the air that's coming in is filtered so that no dust comes in and gets all over your guitar as you're spraying it, and then other filters on the other side to filter the air as it's going out so that the paint fumes don't go out into the regular, into the environment everybody else is living in. But that, just for one guitar, unless you're going to do this all the time, it's not really going to be all that effective for you. I mean, it's not going to be cost effective for you. Spraying outside, outdoors, potentially you're going to be spraying in the sun where it would bubble. I wouldn't recommend that. If you're spraying outside too, there would be bugs and more dust and lint and just different stuff that could be floating around in the air. I don't recommend spraying outside. Definitely do not recommend spraying inside with your family and everything and where you're going to live. And as the fumes come off of the guitar as it's curing, you know, you don't want to be around that. What I've done is I've just done it in my garage. I've hung it up in the garage. It's not a perfect environment. It's not a dust-free environment. It's not perfectly dust-free. And I don't have any, you know, air circulation or anything. But I would wear a respirator. Go to your local paint shop and tell them what you're going to do. And you want a good respirator to keep the fumes out, and wear it. Save your brain cells. Save your lungs. Save your sinuses. Don't put yourself through that. Wear your respirator when you spray this stuff. So what I'm saying is, I went out to my garage, hung the guitar up, put the respirator on, had the garage door closed, and I sprayed and sprayed and sprayed, and did my coats and everything while I was out there. And if I wanted to take a break, I opened up the garage door and let it air out. I mean, it was tacked up enough that it wasn't going to, you know, any dust that would land on it would be surface. It'd be okay anyway. You're going to wet sand it anyway, right? And then I'd go outside and get a breath of fresh air, take the mask off, because the face gets all sweaty underneath those masks. It gets pretty disgusting after you've been working on that for a while. And then I'd go back to it again. Now, you're talking about like the best time of year. You know, here in Indiana, we're coming into late May, and we've already had some humid days here just recently, but today was nice and dry and cool, like, I don't know, low to mid 70s and very dry, almost no air movement. Today would have been a perfect day to spray. And you'll get that. You'll get that from time to time. You know, as they say around here, if you don't like the weather, just wait. So, I mean, if you have the patience, if you can't find the time, just watch the weather for days where it's going to be, where it's going to be fairly dry. It's not going to be super humid or super super dry, but you want arid weather, fairly arid, and not super hot either. So if it's comfortable to you outside, it'll be comfortable for your guitar for painting. Honestly, that's kind of the way I've looked at how things are in the house here for my guitars. Is if I'm comfortable, my guitars are comfortable. If I'm like feeling like it's really hot and muggy or stuffy and humid, then my guitars are feeling the same thing. Chad's next paragraph. Once it's all done, I've heard progressively wet sand from around 800 grit to 15 to 2000 grit and polish using Meguiar's polish or similar, and three different buffing pads that range from rough to super soft. Then hand buff using guitar polish. Do you have any recommendations for the buffing to do on it? I would agree with that. I haven't used Meguiar's. I use Finesset by 3M. I don't know what the price difference is. I have a decent sized bottle of it. I've had for several years now. There's a lot of it. I've used it on a lot of different things. I used it on this Strat project I just did. Actually, okay, so I didn't go to the automotive section and get really nice buffing wheels or anything like that for my project. You're going to call me crazy, say I'm not listening to this guy anymore, but in my relicking project for my Strat, I wanted to polish it back up to a nice gloss and then just let it age from there so it dulls down from what I did. And so a couple months ago, the plastic covers on my headlights in my car had gotten really, really fogged up. And they're just looking really bad, and I'm sure they weren't illuminating the roadway in front of me the way I would prefer they did. So I got this kit for about, what is it, 10, 20 bucks, something like that, where you progressively sand the lens down, fairly rough down to fine, and then it has a buffing compound on like a foam wheel that goes on the head of basically on your drill. And it polished it up so well, and I'm looking at it going, that looks nice and clear and everything. I wonder what that would do on my guitar. Well, I used that wheel on my drill, on my hand drill, and finesse it, and polished up my Strat pretty well. I didn't do it like extensively, so it's like a glistening sheen, just a beautiful, you know, glossy finish. I mean, if I would have taken my time and really wanted to get it there, probably could have done it, but that wasn't really the objective. So, you know, you could go that route too. But I like finesse it. I've used it for hand polishing things out. It's a good rubbing compound. It's a good polish. So I think you're probably on the right track there. I think you'd be fine with the Meguiar's. Next paragraph, the last thing is the neck. I have read to lay 3 to 4 coats of nitro on the neck. I have even heard to spray the fingerboard as well because the nitro will chip off the frets. Other options for the fingerboard are to use fingerboard oil and apply a couple times within 24 hours, with 24 hours between coats. I haven't done much research on the neck yet, but do you have any recommendations? Also, should I plug the holes where the tuning machines go or the lacquer, or let the lacquer set in there? Seems like it would just ream out the lacquer anyways. The same thought goes for any other hole. Should I plug any of them or let them get sprayed? Also, should I lay the pivot pins in the bridge before finishing? I will drill the holes, but I don't know if it matters. The videos I've seen have the pins in place, but they are all being refinished guitars. It doesn't seem like it would matter. Also, spray the neck and body separately or together. I am thinking separately, with the neck recessed, and with the neck recessed taped up. All right, there's several questions in here. When I sprayed my necks, I didn't cover the fretboard or anything like that. Yeah, the lacquer just chips right off. You don't even notice it. I would not fill or tape up where the tuning pegs go. Honestly, I put nice a thin. It's basically a thin layer of lacquer, a thin layer of paint on the guitar. It's not really thick. Honestly, I don't recommend putting a thick layer of anything on the guitar. Thick enough to fill in those holes, not really fill them in, but to make it difficult to reinstall the tuning pegs, I think it's just too much paint, honestly. And same pretty much goes for like screw holes in the body or the neck joint. I don't really tape it off. You probably could tape off the inside of it, but again, if you're not putting a ton of paint in there, which I don't recommend putting a ton of paint in there, you're gonna be fine. One of the last questions here. You know, you should go by the videos. I think they're probably pretty good. If you wanted to keep those pins in place for your tremolo, your bridge, that would not be a bad idea. What I would do is I would take painter tape and wrap those pins and then screw them in to the point where the painter tape touches, and you should be good to go and just go ahead and paint or just pull those bushings out and just paint it and put them back in whenever you're ready to, you know, whenever you're going to reassemble it. Then it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter about the, you know, threading or anything. I would not spray the neck and body together. Definitely spray them separately. Definitely, definitely. And I would not put a whole lot of paint on them. That's just me. Last paragraph. I know I have a lot of info I know I have a lot of info with not a whole lot of questions, but it would could be very helpful to know what worked for you. If you want to reply in the email, that would be great. If you want to answer through the podcast, that's what I'm doing. It could be a great podcast topic, or go over basic spray setup and process. Maybe even talk a little bit about adding color to sealer to make the wood grain pop, and anything related. Honestly, I don't know a whole lot about that. So Chad, I hope that helps out quite a bit. Good luck, and I'd love to see the photos. If you want to share those out on the Facebook page, that would be awesome. I would really dig it. But my experience, I've sprayed a couple different guitars. I don't know what, 3 or 4 maybe. And they've all looked really nice. And biggest thing I recommend is don't put a ton of paint on it. I just don't do it. I know if you took a hammer to a fender from the factory now, chipped off the paint, you'd see how thick that paint is. But I don't agree with it. I don't think the paint needs to be that thick. If you look at a 60s Strat or a 50s Strat where the paint's been chipped off of it, look at the thickness there. And think about that. Think about how great those guitars sound. And part of it is, one, yeah, the nitro is there, and it's a organic type of a compound that breathes and fluxes and is more of a part of the guitar than the finishes that most people put on their guitars now, especially the imports. But I have to think that has something to do with better tone. So, anyway, my two cents. Follow-up question from Chad. I hope you get this before doing the podcast for finishing the guitar. I had an additional question about finishing my guitar. Since I have a bolt-on neck, I asked should I spray the entire guitar as one. It seems to me that I should do them separately now. If that's the case, should I spray the base? Should I spray the base of the neck that will sit in the pocket on the body, then sand the area to fit the body? The same goes for the neck pocket. Should it be sprayed and then sanded for the neck to fit? Seems like the neck pocket should be masked before spraying. I don't think so. I don't think it really needs to. Just don't spray a whole lot there. Don't focus your spraying there. Nobody's going to. I mean, if you get a little color in there just to seal the thing up, maybe one or two passes should be plenty for the neck pocket. If you put too much in there, sure, you can sand that a little bit to open that up. So the neck fits in better, but really, if you're putting so much paint on there that it's too tight, then I mean, either the neck pocket was too tight to begin with, or you put too much paint, too thick of paint. And I would just be very careful about how much paint you put on there, mainly because of tone and two because of fit. I don't know that I would tape any of that stuff off. But Chad, thanks again for the question. I hope that works out for you, and I'd love to see the finished product. Here's some cool feedback. I love this. Hey, I just discovered your podcast about 5 minutes ago. I'm your newest feed burner. I'm your newest feed burner subscriber. I've been playing bass for a few years, and now my buddy's guitar player quit, and he wants me to try out for the spot. I'm getting all new gear, practicing each night, and trying to listen to some advice during my day job. Thanks for publishing these shows. I started with episode 38. Things Not to Do at a Band First, but I'll be going through your archives all day. I noticed you're running WordPress. If you need any plugins, let me know. That's what I do for a living. I've got some free ones too. So, thanks, Corey. I'm going to hide that email away for reference, for help when I need it, because I've really haven't done a whole lot on my WordPress stuff, and I think you and I have gone back and forth on some things for improvements to do there. So I'm filing you away as a resource. And good luck with your transition from bass to guitar. You should do pretty well. Corey follows up with, I just listened to episode 51, Pickups, where you mentioned shut off comments on the blog because of spam, and that you prefer Facebook for discussion. How's that working out? I don't have a Facebook account, so I can't check. I do get decent discussions going there on Facebook, but it's not like a forum, and it's not like a blog, really. I've had very few comments on the blog, and I've opened that up to discussion again. So the spammers have just kind of abandoned the site for some reason, or the spam blocking software in there, the filters have started doing their job. So that's pretty cool. Also, he says he's made a few plugins that are designed to cut down on comment spam, and there are also some settings in your WordPress
They can help too. If you're going to reconsider using the blog comments, I can help you out. So thanks a lot, Corey. I'm filing this away, and I really appreciate that. Where is that? There's one email. Oh, this is it. Love it. This thing. This email just blew me out of the water, folks. It's a long one, and hopefully I can read it and make it sound right. But it's from Kyle from iris9design.com. And I checked out the website, too. It's pretty cool. Kyle says, "What's up? I just found you on iTunes about a month ago. I honestly have to write you and let you know that in all the 8-hour work days since then that I spent doing art and waiting for 5 p.m., aka guitar time, to roll around, I've listened to your show, episode 1 through 74, that was current, pretty much without stopping. Despite my father being an accomplished musician and growing up being around guitars all my life, I just started playing guitar 5 months ago for the first time, at age 28 no less. Not to mention my only previous musical experience having been producing electronic music and turntablism up to that point. Since January, I've been playing 6 to 8 hours a day in addition to a full-time job and living with a rowdy girlfriend. I've learned guitar so fast, I honestly can't believe it. I certainly can recognize everything I don't know, but just that positively focuses my hours of practice. I honestly believe, quite humbly, but truthfully, that I have learned guitar much faster than the average student. I realize that this is probably due more to my personal drive and work ethic than the fact that I learned in the digital age and that I'm about to talk what I'm about to talk about. But that's a whole other discussion. Little side note, folks, it does take a lot of drive and energy to get in there and do it. Steve Vai didn't just happen to learn how to play guitar the way he does. He worked a lot. Okay, continuing. That brings me to my question, one where your respected classic knowledge meets the ways kids and big kids growing up are learning guitars these days and how different it is from how someone may have learned even just 10, 20 years ago. Things like practicing on broken up or overdriven $2,000 amp quietly in your house at night because the tone is coming right off your phone, or how about the way I can have any tab of any song ever with 5 minutes on Google. 10 years ago, you would have to spend $25 on a book and music store and be able to play anything that didn't make you feel like you were playing your dad's music, in quotes. That was the closest I ever got to playing guitar before this year." All right, I'd like to speak to that a little bit. If I were 16 now and had the internet and YouTube and everything, I'm sure that I would be progressing much quicker than I did. I mean, I did pretty well when I was a teenager playing guitar, and I bought guitar for the practicing musician, and I learned songs out of there. I'd play with friends and learn songs from them. I took guitar lessons and learned from them. Another thing was you just turn the radio on and start playing along with the radio. At that point, you're developing your ear. It's not being spoon-fed to you. Not that there's anything wrong with being spoon-fed by YouTube or any other online video website that people show how to play songs and stuff. I think it's great. The more you know, the better, right? And that's still training your ear. But whenever your mind, your ears, your hands are opening up doors into where you're what you're hearing on the radio, and you're seeing it happen on your guitar, there's something really special about that. So, and I'm not saying that it's bad to do it either way. I think that there probably is something slightly missing from playing through, you know, a modulation or an amp emulator. I mean, they'll sound pretty good, but there's got to be something missing there as opposed to taking an old Fender or old Marshall and cranking it up in an open room with no reverb and just letting the room's natural ambiance echo and give you that give you a natural reverb, a natural delay. There's something really super special about that. I think all these experiences are probably good for everybody. You know, like a, you know, old school guy like me, getting on YouTube and learning stuff, it's great. I love it. There's a James Taylor has on his website basically all these different angles showing how he plays his songs. It's really pretty insane. It's pretty amazing. Great resource. And I find YouTube to be a great resource. And there are a bunch of people online who have instructional video websites for guitar. Great stuff to have. But sometimes it doesn't really replace having a guitar teacher right in front of you. Not that I'm going, oh, you know, not promoting the people to go and take lessons from me or anybody else. It's just, this is for you. So my two cents on that deal about, you know, now as opposed to 10, 20, 25 years ago, it's just different. Just like the old timers that, you know, that came up in the 60s when I was playing in the 80s, like, you know, they didn't have tablature back in the 60s. And that was a big deal. It was a really big deal when people started throwing tablature out there. You didn't have to read music. You didn't have to know all this stuff. You just learned it and you played it. You know, there's a lot less thought, less steep of a learning curve to play guitar with tablature than there is with learning, you know, you have to read music too. My opinion. His next paragraph, now to the real point of my discussion. It's crazy how many resources there are out there for people who learn guitar these days, this day and age. Do you know where I learned how to solo with all five pentatonic minor shapes after playing guitar for only 3 months? YouTube. Do you know where I learned to play guitar note for note? Wait, do you know where I learned to play note for note, including every bend and solo, songs ranging from Nirvana, Eric Clapton, Rolling Stones, and Lynyrd Skynyrd? An Xbox 360 game called Rocksmith that I bought on a whim and borrowed my dad's old school Fender Tele for 2 weeks. Do you know where I learned about the black keys, true bypass, tone suck, that Marshall amps are British, and therefore British 60s is an awesome setting on my digital modeling amp, the difference between a Tele and a Strat, how to get the most out of my Les Paul Studio, cheap, $400, but well played, deeply loved, and absolutely amazing, what to look for in an effects pedal, always trust my ear, that I should never sell my dearly loved and previously mentioned Les Paul, and way too many other things to list. The Guitar Podcast, of course. I felt like I would be ungrateful if I didn't share that. And side note, folks, when I read that to my wife, and that really made that was just great. That made me feel great and makes me feel like, you know, hey, I'm doing something for somebody out there, you know. So that's great. I really appreciate the email, Kyle. I want to continue on with this. I know this goes on for a while, but it's pretty good. I always see these big debates on forums around the internet, at the guitar store, everywhere. That being said, here's my question for the digital age versus the classic one. When I have to be quiet, my favorite way to practice is in GarageBand, which is running on my iPhone and plugged in through a special phone's sound card into my headphones, because I usually have to practice late at night if I want more than 1 or 2 hours a day of playing time, not to mention $4.99 for GarageBand. Seriously. You can't even buy a pack of decent strings for that. You do have to have, or do you do have, $30 to $100 on hardware, but that's just guitars. As you all know even better than me. And I'm going to comment on that now, Kyle. Whatever it takes to get the practice in. I knew. When I was growing up, I was living with my folks, and I'd play, and I couldn't really plug into my guitar amp after hours, and we didn't have. I mean, we had some little amps and stuff you could plug your earphones in, and it just sounded like garbage. Honestly, I felt better about just playing my guitar unplugged, my electric, just, you know, watching the TV real low, and I just play it like so, without it being plugged in. Now, if you have iTunes and you can get, you know, these amp modeling tones and they sound great and extend your practice and you can really learn to use all the cool stuff that's on your guitar when it's overdriven or clean or has nice reverbs or delays and stuff, by all means, I think that's great. I wish, honestly, I wish it was around, you know, when I was a kid or when I was learning. I mean, you're not a kid, you're 28, but, you know, my grandpa used to always say, you know, they always talk about the good old days, but if you really think back about it, the good old days weren't so great. You know, that we've got it pretty good now. Things are really better now than they were, you know, in a lot of ways. And I know some of you may be saying, well, what are you talking about, Lauren? These are hard economic times. It's not as good as it was 10 years ago, and so on and so forth. But that's not really what I'm getting at. I'm getting at the fact that the technologies, the luxuries that we have these days are better than what we had 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And we should really be thankful of that. I just wish some of the other things that that were high quality 30, 40, 50 years ago didn't cost an arm and a leg to get a hold of as they do now. You know, that they didn't cost an arm and a leg to get a hold of them in the 50s and 60s. That's one of the things about, you know, the good old days that aren't necessarily there. He continues on. The amps in GarageBand sound simply amazing. I am also comparing that to my Fender Mustang 3 digital modeling amp. Cheap and also sounds great. Remember, still only been playing 5 months and native instruments with the Rig Control 3 sound card, complete digital modeling software, foot pedal emulator also sounds pretty killer and is amazing in a studio setting as a VST. I am then comparing all of these to everything I have played at Guitar Center. I'm lucky and cursed to live 3 minutes from one. As well as every piece of music I have ever heard, I have over a terabyte of legally bought and ripped records and CDs on my iTunes from years as a DJ and audiophile and music collector. All that being said, good thing you're also a guitar nerd to have made it this far. What are all the amps? All three manufacturers of the emulators have for obvious copyright purposes, make up some parody name or skin the amp in a visual parody of the colors and textures of the original. It's easy even for me to figure out the black and gold skin is a classic Marshall, the diamond plate is a Mesa Boogie, and the black trim with a silver fabric screen is a Fender. See where I'm going. There's a black and maroon amp there's a black and maroon amp in there, and I don't know what it is, but it sounds like it's sending my guitar through hopes and dreams. And there are a whole bunch of others that look the same from program to program as well, and I also recognize them from real life. Knowing them all would be amazing and probably taken for granted by someone like you, not to even mention knowing what to do with them. What was it like when they came out? Why is it important? Who broke the most ground with it and why? I feel like that is what I get a piece every time I turn on your podcast, and I love it. Well, thanks, Kyle, but I don't really know what amp that is. I was wondering maybe, you know, I talked with a friend of mine about what amp that might be, the black and maroon amp. I have no idea. Perhaps a listener can chime in and email us and let us know, or post on the blog, or on the post on the show notes, or post out on Facebook what that black and maroon amp was or is, because that could be helpful to you whenever you decide you want to get a real amp, if that's, you know, something you want to do, a nice tube amp that just basically does what it does. and doesn't have all the modeling and all these effects and stuff in it. That's where I get old school and say the amp just needs to do what it does. Keep it simple, and you're going to have great tone, and then build on it from there. You just start adding little things here and there. Subtlety is really the key to all this stuff, in my opinion. Of course, then again, you get a guy like The Edge with U2, and the subtlety is, and subtlety in rock and roll isn't really all that either. So, I guess, in some ways, when it comes to effects, you want to be very subtle. In other ways, you want to be like way over the top, because Eddie Van Halen is pretty over the top with a lot of his effects back in the day, too. So, anyway, back to the email, and there's not much left of this, folks. I used to spend every dollar I had on vinyl records, eat or go get two copies of that on vinyl. Well, I ate yesterday, I saw the analog DJ taken over by the new digital DJ, freaked out, then embraced it. God only knows what tomorrow will bring, but if I know one thing to be true, it's that no matter how far technology takes us, it will always be based on the way we have done things in the past. Digital versus analog, technology versus tradition. It's not a competition or a game to see what's better. It's all points on the same timeline. It says, sorry for the long email, but you seem like someone I would have fun conversation with in real life. And you just got to have my ear for 70 episodes over a month straight. So, man, you got a heavy dose of the guitar podcast and this goofball named Lauren Hunt talking in your ear about guitars. So, you know, and I have to agree that, you know, I don't like some of the new technology that is out there for guitars, but I do like some of the new technology out there for guitars. So I think it's just what really works, where they're maybe experimenting and trying to get somewhere, they're not quite there yet, or they're just going down the wrong path with another thing. You know, on my pedal board, my delay, I have two delays. One's a faux analog delay, or faux tape delay, and which is very analog, and then I have the digital delay. Everything else on there is analog. So I'm keeping it fairly, you know, fairly old school that way. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, blending the two. If something is good and they can go together, then by all means, rock it. All right, folks. Well, I'm up near an hour on this episode, so I think I'm gonna call it quits for the night. Hope to record another one soon, sooner than later. I keep saying that, but it always seems to be about a week before I get another one out. I've been working on some videos. I want to get those edited and up on YouTube and share those with you. Basically from that trip to Cincinnati and Kentucky, Lexington, and show you those. Those are pretty cool. I had a really good time with that. So pretty much wraps it up for today's episode of the Guitar Podcast. Please email me with questions at info@theguitarpodcast.net. Comment on Facebook. If you liked what you heard today and you subscribe using iTunes or Zoom, please let them know by writing a review. Thanks for tuning in again. This is Lauren Hunt signing off for the Guitar Podcast.